Thanks for joining us now on the show. And you've said since then that there are various things that you'd like to share with us, various developments. You said to me in a text message, particularly about this guy who recruited Sergei Skripal to sell secrets, Russian secrets, a man called Pablo Miller, and the fact that both Skripal and Miller have links to this chap called Christopher Steele. The company Orbis Intelligence, of course, people will know that name because of the Steele being the source for this famous Trump Russia dossier. So, I mean, I'm interested to know what you think the connections are here between these various people and, you know, what the significance of all that is.
Well, look, before I answer that one, Julian, I think I'd just like to say something about the fact that people are talking about this story all over the country. In the pubs, in the supermarket cafes, and none of those sorts of conversations are making their way onto our television screens, into our radio stations, or occasionally, I mean, maybe the odd phone-in. And that's a very important way to get these things discussed. Actually, there is no proper journalism going on in this story whatsoever. What's happened is the opposite, really, which is lies and disinformation which haven't been checked against reality, which have been fed to journalists by presumably by Ministry of Defence press officers, police press officers, Cabinet Office press officers, and then just regurgitated as fact, are being reported as fact with no checking of any of these facts by the journalists. So not only are they not asking questions in their own minds, but they're not going to the actual source, supposed source of the story, and checking. So just for one example, there was a report that scores of people in Salisbury had also been subject to this nerve agent, and that they'd, you know, gone into Salisbury District Hospital or surgeries and been treated for nerve agent. Now, this was proven by the emergency medicine doctors at Salisbury District Hospital to be a lie. He actually wrote to, I think it was the Telegraph or the Guardian, saying nobody apart from these three people had been treated at all for any kind of nerve agent. So you do just beg a belief that when you're reading something in the newspaper that tells you something about this story, particularly because it's highly politically charged, it may be just complete nonsense and lies. You know the old phrase, fake news. There's been a really, I think, it says it's more almost about the state of our press in Britain, this Novichok Salisbury story, than it does about the story itself. It's almost like the story kind of dissolves as you see another thing and you think to yourself, well, this sounds like nonsense. Look, let's just start with...
And it's interesting, though, that John Pilger described it as carefully crafted. You're saying it's not carefully crafted?
I don't think so. No, I think it's almost like on the back of an envelope, lies. I mean, look, for example, I worked for the BBC between 1992, 93, into 94. I think it was roughly around those years, for about 18 months in Salisbury as a reporter for the BBC in Salisbury, for working for what they called the Salisbury opt-out on Wiltshire Sound, which was the BBC station for Wiltshire. It still is. I mean, it's called something else like BBC Wiltshire now. But we had an office in Salisbury and I was working in there almost every day to a news producer. And the area itself, well, it's about as military as it's possible to get, really. I mean, you think about, for a start, the main UK military training area for all sorts of types of forces, including things like the... fleet air arm, you know, aircraft using it as a bombing practice and target practice, liaison with the ground, for example, practice, that sort of thing. I guess that's what they probably call close air support, something like that, you know, where aircraft are supporting troops on the ground. All that was being done on Salisbury Plain, which is this massive part of Wiltshire, right next to Salisbury, extremely militarised up. And they do all the training and testing around there. There's whole areas around Balfour and Tidworth which are totally and utterly military, quite large areas which are totally fenced off, you can't go into. So Wiltshire is about as militarised up as it's possible to be, with Salisbury Plain dominating the county. You know, it's actually quite nice. If anyone lives around there, you can go there Easter and Christmas time, mm-hmm. and over the New Year, and you're actually allowed to drive through. For, you know, you get if you see any red flags, turn back. Yeah, but the military
do
allow
you. Not avoid bumping into Porton Down as well, can you? Well, how many miles away is that from Salisbury?
Well, it's very close. Yeah, Porton Down is very close. But let me just finish what I was saying. There is actually a church in the abandoned village of Imber, which you can go and see at Easter and Christmas, which is actually an amazing sight. It's just a village which is now pretty much gone, apart from the village pub, which is used as part of training by the military, and the church is fenced off, and it's the only kind of thing left there really of the village. And there has been a campaign for many years to get people to have their land back, because they were booted out in the Second World War. But anyway, I'd suggest, for wildlife and all sorts of things, birds of prey, all sorts of the Salisbury Plain is a wonderful place to go, and it is actually quite accessible, particularly around the periphery. But, you know, there's also, as you say, we've got Porton Down, but not just that, which is the Chemical Biological Weapons Centre. You've also got Boscombe Down, which is the military's, it's a super long runway, the RAF's testing station, which is where they developed the bouncing bomb, for example, in the Second World War. There's the Land Warfare Centre at Wilton, which is just a couple of miles west of Salisbury. And then you've got something I discovered, which I don't know if it's supposed to be public, but certainly it was well known to us. The underground nuclear weapons stores, places like various places dotted around there. Like
Tony's talking about Chilmark Nuclear Weapons Store and Quarry in Wiltshire.
It's with a T, but anyway, it was where the stone came from to build Salisbury Cathedral. They dug the stone out and they found a massive kind of stone quarry there under the ground, and they were using that to store nukes and various other highly, you know, toxic stuff. Anyway, Salisbury looks like a lovely little kind of tourist-y town with its beautiful cathedral and spire, but actually everywhere you go is military, almost everywhere. And let's not forget the history of that part of the country, because Stonehenge was seen by the ancients, the prehistoric people, as the centre of the country, the most important place, you know, best defended military place, which is why the military, I think, are still there today. It's because it's right at the heart of the country. And if you can't defend that, then you can't defend anything. So it is very, you know, the other thing, when you talk about Porton Down, that is very close by. It's 10 minutes drive from Salisbury. And I can remember when I was working there, they had a place, they just closed it. This is in the early 90s, which was the Common Cold Research Centre. Now, there's lots of people have had problems over the years because they were doing all sorts of trying viruses out on people there. Is this going to, you know, really cause a lot of problems for you medically or not? And so there was a positive aspect to it, because they were finding out about the common cold, but there was also the link between there and Porton Down, because they were very closely linked, that and the Common Cold Research Centre. And there were lots and lots of military who were basically used as guinea pigs horrendously by giving them about £10 a week extra in the 1950s and 1960s. Many of them were on public, were on national service, you know, so they didn't have any choices whether to be in the military. And back in 2000, there was the inquiry launched into 45 deaths. So we're talking about 45 servicemen, that's Royal Marines and Army mostly, who volunteered for Porton Down testing of various sorts, told it was all safe, all above board, blah, blah, and then died as a result. That's absolutely appalling.
They tested sarin on them, didn't they?
They tested all sorts of things, they still haven't said all the different things they tested on them. I've spoken personally to one guy who, he was being tested in one of these kind of nuclear chemical biological suits, you know, gas mask and everything, and they encountered some kind of substance which made all the soldiers start laughing their heads off, and they tore off the suits because they were uncontrollable giggles. And of course that would then expose them much more to anything that was out there. No, this is they were guinea pigs, Julian. Appalling way to treat people. And then in 2008 there was, I think, a paltry sum of £3 million was issued as compensation. So anyway, there was a lot of courageous people that took, and actually BBC Points West here in Bristol was quite influential in getting that, you know, sort of into the public eye and getting the courts to take that whole business seriously. So look, at the end of the day, the question is, can you trust Porton Down? The answer is no. You cannot trust.
I have no love for Porton Down because I was brought up in Swanage on the south coast. And as listeners will know, I spoke to somebody who was telling me that Porton Down was involved in the spraying of live bacteria out in the coast there, out in the bay. And, when I was a child, I had frequent chest infections. And of course, I don't know if there's any connection there, but I do wonder if that is in fact connected to what they were doing.
Well, it could well be, couldn't it? Mm-hmm. But it's also very interesting that there's been really hardly any mention of Porton Down being nearby and being a potential source for this nerve agent in the reporting, which to me is just laughable, really. It's the most obvious potential reason. And I actually spoke to a former army officer today who worked at Porton Down as part of his job. He's an army officer, and he said, oh yes, they definitely had Novichok there, so no doubt about it. The interesting things about the story, the nerve agents, they kill people very, very quickly and very efficiently and very effectively. They're extremely dangerous substances. Even just a tiny droplet of this stuff on you can kill you. Which begs the question, well, we got three people who weren't killed by this. I mean, if the Russian state was behind this and they wanted to kill any of these people, they would be dead, no doubt about it. It's just impossible, really, not to kill people. So something's gone wrong somewhere, or else the story doesn't stack up.
Did you pick up on the story of a medical professional who gave assistance to them and who was not hurt in any way, but the policeman was? That doesn't seem to add up at all.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't make any sense, does it? Unless potentially the policeman was administering the nerve agent. You know, is that impossible that the policeman might have been doing that? One of the first things I heard from some colleagues in Salisbury was that they were extremely surprised that a detective sergeant was the first person on the scene. I mean, normally the first person on the scene would be a PC, and the detective sergeant would only get involved at a much later stage once an investigation had been launched, possibly potential charges had been gotten ready, arrest warrants prepared, that sort of thing. The detectives get involved. This is the CID, which the DS, detective sergeant, was a much later stage, certainly not the first person on the scene. So that's immediately suspicious. So the other thing is the timing with the Russian election, just a couple of weeks afterwards. Was the story designed to interfere with the Russian election? We've been making a lot of fuss about the Russians interfering in our elections without a lot of evidence, has to say. So maybe we're accusing them of what we're doing through operations like this. I mean, you started by asking about the whole Pablo Miller, Jonathan Steele, Orbis intelligence business, and that does definitely look suspicious. Obviously, this guy, Sergei Skripal, most definitely would still, I would suggest, still have a grudge against Russia and against the Russians, having obviously taken the Queen's shilling and betrayed his country and being ridiculed by his country, even though he was involved in a spy swap. He certainly wasn't very well respected there. So he, may well have had a grudge against the Russians. And so we'd been quite willing to take part in any kind of psychological operation against Russia. So certainly that fits potentially. But, the idea that he's working with this private company, which is basically an MI6 front, it seems, from Jonathan Steele, who wrote the Trump dossier. So I've even had someone suggest to me that maybe Trump did it as a way to get back at Jonathan Steele for writing this document. I mean, it's quite clearly MI6's fingerprints all over this, and we know MI6 are designed to kill, designed to lie. That's what they do. The only trouble is they seem to be using some of their MI6 tactics, their James Bond techniques, against the British public, against British politicians. That's the target for this, and against British lawmakers, against all officials in Britain. This is, I think, as a way of bending their minds to hate Russia more, because there's so many holes in this story. I mean, it's almost like a rush to judgment. That's the, I think, for me, in a way, the biggest hole of all was, we've decided who did it, literally in 12 hours after it's happened. We've decided what happened. We decided who did it. We've decided why. Look, no sensible person can make, number one, a actual decision, and number two, then a whole load of diplomatic expulsion acts based on that decision when you haven't even got the facts and the evidence together. So this is definitely a rush to judgment. And I think one of the best commentators on all of it has been the former Uzbekistan ambassador, Craig Murray, who Martin mentioned quite a lot, who's pointed out it's of a, this Novichok nerve agent is of a type developed by Russia. Well, that doesn't mean anything. And as we've just heard, you know, I think there's something like 13 countries, including South Africa, that have developed this stuff and had files of it. I suppose they keep it in some of the little glass jars or something, or maybe something stronger than glass, who knows. Then we hear stories about a woman with a red suitcase disappearing up an alleyway just after the couple were discovered.
Just to go back to that of a type developed by Russia, that was quite an important point, wasn't it, that Craig Murray was making there, that this was a sort of compromise phrase that Porton Down, and he says anyway, that Porton Down agreed to because they couldn't actually pin this on Russia, but they were sort of arm-twisted into accepting a phrase that now has been repeated all over the place, isn't it? I mean, everywhere you listen, everywhere you hear, that is the phrase that's coming out.
Well, it may even be true that the Russians developed this, and you know they published it as a quick and easy way of making a reasonably effective nerve agent. But that does not mean that it was actually administered by them. Especially since we know, actually, I mean, the most obvious source for this is 10 minutes down the road, Julian.
Yes. Yes. Yes, I mean, I wasn't saying that it's necessarily not true, but what I'm saying, and I think this is what Craig Murray was implying, was that this phrase is being used as a way of saying only Russia could do it. It doesn't mean that, but that's the way it's being employed as a phrase.
Yes, that's right. It's all psychological, isn't it? Also, I think the media coverage of it, I mean, there's one or two really appalling things. I mean, basically, Jeremy Corbyn is saying, look, let's just abide by the international regulations, by the rule of law. Let's just do this by the book. And as a result, there's a picture of him appears on Newsnight with a Photoshop cap looking very Russian with the Kremlin in the background. And it's really an attempt to fit him up as a Russian agent. Now, this is exactly what the establishment did to Harold Wilson in the 1970s, fitting him up as apparently a Russian agent. And this is what they do to people who are actually trying to abide by the law and do what the ordinary British people want. I think we've got a kind of criminal...
I find it very interesting that it was... I'm not sure when it was. It was probably a couple of years ago or so, wasn't it? But when it was said, wasn't it, by some... I can't remember. Somebody in the military, high up in the military, was saying that if Jeremy Corbyn ever comes to power, there will be... You know, the military would rebel against that.
Well, they say he wouldn't pass vetting as well.
Right.
Yeah. So, in connection
with this, I'm just wondering whether you think what happened a few weeks back, when there was this business of him, of Jeremy Corbyn having had connections with a Czech communist spy, whether that is actually part of this operation that's going on here, because there's been a link back to that in the news, hasn't there? You know, you can see that that there are these connections to the Cold War. Communism back in those days. Look, it's all connected up here. He won't blame Russia, etc.
Yes, of course. I mean, you know, I think what's going on here is we've got these military psychological warfare units in Britain. One of the probably the well, the most obvious one is the place that trains psychological warfare officers in Chicksands in Bedfordshire. But now we've got this thing which was announced. It was probably about 3 or 4 years ago, called Brigade 77, which I wonder whether it's actually anything to do with the 7/7 bombings that they've called it that. Who knows? I mean, it's a sort of in joke that they like to do. But this is a psychological warfare unit. Now, I wonder whether these sorts of units are being used, and maybe it's just people who have been worked there and trained there and are now employed in the private sector, are being used to cook these sorts of stories up. I think they realise that there's nobody in Britain who is going to stop the British military or private businesses like Bell Pottinger, for example. And it's just an example. Bell Pottinger is a basics. It was a London-based firm which was taking money from the Pentagon to manufacture fake Al-Qaeda videos and then get them shown on the British TV. And this is the sort of thing I think we might be witnessing here, is the same kind of process where the military are funding private companies to cook up whole sort of propaganda narratives to then be fed to the British people. Because the thing is, at least they can, I mean, they can't get the Russians to broadcast this nonsense, but they can get people within Britain to do it. So as they've run out of options on foreign policy internationally, they've been blocked in Syria and Ukraine by Russia, been blocked by China elsewhere, they're thinking, well, look, we might as well use these against our own people. At least we can, you know, bamboozle them into, you know, coming up with kind of foreign policy results we want. Look, one really other important part of this, which is, hang on, just let me finish this, because there's one really
important... I just wanted, before you go on to the next thing about it, are you actually suggesting here that the whole Skripal affair is, well, it's kind of made up?
I mean, it could be a drama. It could be a drama we're watching here. I haven't seen any evidence of these. I mean, when we had Alexander Litvinenko in hospital, we kept having photographs of him on the front page of the papers every day. When he was poisoned, incidentally, that was all to do with Boris Berezovsky in Russia too. And I think Litvinenko was poisoned because he was starting to realise that there was a much bigger game going on. He wrote a book, Blowing Up Russia, about Berezovsky and Putin getting together to blow up housing blocks, basically housing estates in Moscow, in order to blame it on the Chechens and get the Chechen war started. Well, what happened was, because Putin in his role in the I think he was in St. Petersburg at the time, or was he deputy? I think he was acting prime minister. Berezovsky decided that Putin was, you know, kind of wrapped up in this, and therefore, if he ever needed to get rid of Putin, he could just threaten him with saying, look, I'm going to expose your role in these bombings. He thought that Putin would be his little puppet as a prime minister and then as a president. Anyway, so then he became president after Yeltsin, and Putin basically turned the tables on him by going to the chief prosecutor's office and saying, look, there's some old charges we've got on Berezovsky to do with the privatisation of Aeroflot. And that's the guy that's just died in London. He was the finance manager for Aeroflot. And so what happened there was the Aeroflot case was reinstituted by Putin. And that meant that Berezovsky had to go in and testify. He had two Swiss companies that had been involved in that, you know, basically asset stripping Aeroflot and taking all the money. This is how people like Berezovsky made all their money, these oligarchs, by just asset stripping the whole country like they've done here in the West. So, long story short, Berezovsky was phoned by Putin, and he said, look, just to let you know, because you're a mate, I'll let you know this, that in 24 hours, the police are going to come and arrest you and charge you with some of these charges over this Aeroflot business and various other things where you've stolen government money or government assets. And so I'm just doing this as a favour to you to let you know that it's probably a good idea if you get out of the country tonight. You know, so Berezovsky did. He flew to London. And that was it. Berezovsky's then tried to use this whole business of the Moscow Ryazan bombings in 1999 to blackmail Putin, but the West doesn't want him to do that, as Martin explained. But this background, I think, is quite, you know, is important. If you look at the way that Litvinenko story ran out, there was pictures all the time. Now, why haven't we seen pictures of these ill people in the hospital? I think we need a bit more evidence that what is we're being told happened actually happened. But anyway, the point I was trying to get onto was about who is behind the policy of escalating tension with Russia. Who is behind it? It doesn't seem to be in the British national interest at all, because a nuclear war with Russia would lead to the deaths of millions of British people. You know, it would basically be the end for us. I mean, it would just be horrendous and horrific. So whose interest is it in? Well, difficult. I mean, maybe the US sees Britain as expendable. Obviously, so long as they can still fly jet planes off of Britain and store nuclear bombs here, they don't really care what happens to the rest of the country. It doesn't matter to the American military. It's just so long as there's something hard for them to land their B-1 bombers on or launch their various missiles from and have their radar bases on, they don't care about the population running around here in the UK. So it could well be the Pentagon. The other thing, of course, is the Israelis as well are very annoyed about the way that the Russians have blocked them in the Middle East and of course MI6 too, who are very close to both of those two. But the people who are really pushing this are called the Royal Institute for International Affairs. That's Chatham House in London, which is just close to Prince Charles's palace, St James's Palace, just off Piccadilly. And you can wander past the place if you want, because these are the guys that have been doing all the analysis that says Russia did it, Russia did it, Russia did it, and actually leading the way. And I can tell you, when I was at the BBC in London, we were told all the time, whenever there was some sort of international crisis or whatever, oh, ask Chatham House. The only other people we really got on, I mean, we didn't get the Foreign Office for whatever reason. I mean, I can't even think why. You know, they would be the obvious people to call to get a spokesperson to speak on the radio. The other lot were the Royal United Services Institute, and they seem to be a bit more reasonable. But Chatham House is completely funded by the corporates. I mean, that is to say the banks, the hedge funds, the big... for people like car manufacturers, big media. This is a private think tank that is actually now setting our foreign policy, because they're far better funded, and their policy journals, I'm not sure what the Royal Institute for International Affairs one is called. We've got an equivalent in the US, which is called the Council on Foreign Relations. But these two institutions, the CFR in the US and the RIIA, or Chatham House, they also it's nicknamed, in London, are actually driving all of this. And that is simply because those institutions, the funders of those institutions, see Russia as a threat to their expansionist policies, what in Ukraine, in the Black Sea, and in the Eastern Mediterranean, which is key to controlling the the Middle East.
So would that observation fit with what Finian Cunningham wrote a couple of weeks ago, a week ago or so, about this could be opposition to the Nord Stream gas line? Many in the US and the EU consider the gas line would give Moscow too much power over Europe.
Well, look, they're just trying to block the Russians in. They're trying to just completely deny the rest of the world to the Russians. Yeah. Let's not make no bones about it. When we had the MH17 go down in Ukraine a few years ago, that was when the European Union introduced sanctions. There was, again, no proper evidence that the Russians had done that. But then they decided they're going to institute sanctions. Just a few weeks ago, they had sanctions. The Americans put sanctions on loads of, I think it was 50 different major firms in China that have been trading with North Korea in one way or another. Now, these are acts of war, Julian. The economic warfare is sanctions. Sanctions are economic warfare. And nowadays, this is really just a precursor. What they're doing is they're signalling very clearly to the Russians, is to say, we'd like to fight you, but not yet. Maybe in a few months or a few weeks' time. And if you don't do as we say, we're going to put more and more sanctions. We're going to isolate you even more. We won't trade with you. And what this does is it has a negative effect on their national economic prospects and investment, yes, and that sort of thing. So it's really a way of kind of kicking them without actually shooting them in the head. It's just another form of warfare, just as this psychological warfare is. And in fact, the Saker, who's a very good international analyst, his website is called vineyardsaker.is. He is a former UN military analyst who was booted out because he kept telling people things they didn't want to hear, a bit like maybe me at the BBC. Look, his analysis of this is that modern warfare is, I think he's, try and get the figures exactly right, I think he was 80% psychological warfare, that is to say bamboozling the public, bending their minds, lying to them, conning them. And not it's not just the public, of course, it's politicians. And people are like sheep. They just go along. The politicians don't want to stick their neck out. They want to make sure that they're going to be back in another term. They don't want to say something which is going to attract the attention of the major newspapers pillorying them. And it's 80% psychological warfare using the mainstream media, the corporate media mainly. And then 15% economic warfare, and only 5% is actually fighting. So I think the modern major war, what we'd see is much more propaganda, much more economic warfare, which of course was happening between the wars on Germany, really to punish Germany for the First World War, when we know where that led. And the actual fighting will be very, very sharp and quick. So if the Russians decide, as they threaten to do, to retaliate against the United States for any attack on their troops in Syria, which is effectively Russian, I mean, don't even think of trying to take hold of Syria. It's Russian territory. They need it in order to survive. So if you try and take Syria away from Russia, what you're saying is we want Russia to die. We're going to kill your country. That's why the Russians have really stuck with Assad, because they know they need it. And when that happens, that will be so fast, Julian. It will be very, very quick. We'll be wham, bam, thank you, ma'am. We might see military bases across Norfolk, for example, hit with Russian weapons, not necessarily nuclear initially, but quite possibly, you know, various things destroyed, like, you know, aircraft hangars, control towers with precision guided weapons. We will then likely see attacks on, I mean, the first I would suggest would be US bases in Britain. They would be places like Menwith Hill, places like that would be hit. And then we might well see British bases being hit if the British decided to go along with an American assault on Russia. So that's really what we're looking at. And I think it would be very, very fast. And
but would it escalate immediately to the nuclear dimension?
Not necessarily, no. But I think we're actually moving towards that. Now we've got the US and the Russians squaring up against each other in Syria. We've got immense pressure being put on Trump by the Israel lobby to basically do what they want, do what Israel want in the Middle East. And we've had that here in the UK as well. Tremendous pressure and a great deal of power of the Israel lobby in the British media. One thing you can say to prove that is how little real historical criticism there's been of the whole Zionist project in the press and the media here. Another story which I just came across the other day, because I've just come back from Australasia. In Australia, there's a 34 charges, including rape, against an Israeli in an Orthodox Jewish school in Australia. And this woman managed to skip the country before the police got her. And in Israel, she's just been let free. You know, this is the sort of thing that we're not getting reported over here, that you've got organised child sex abuse, which is being supported by the Israeli state because someone, maybe it's because she's Israeli. I mean, it's probably nothing to do with Jewishness, but that sort of thing needs to be reported.
You're not allowed to criticise political Israel at all, are you? I mean, this is another thing that Craig Murray talks about. He said that Israel was a possibility in this equation, and a lot of people have attacked him as being an anti-Semite just because he said that. But I mean, it's a possibility, logically speaking.
Yes, it is. And there is a very basic, Glenn Greenwald very brilliantly, I think, pointed this out. He said, look, if you try and fight Israel, you're a terrorist. And if you try and you want to do it peacefully, through peaceful means, you're an anti-Semite. Whatever happens, you will shut up, you will agree. Now, this is, you know, actually a very totalitarian attitude that's been promulgated and actually been supported for quite a while within the senior ranks of the Labour Party. I hope that's all come to an end now.
Going back to Chatham House, I noticed in a reproduction of one of their articles on your forum that the reasons they give, the motives they give for Putin, Putin having done this, are extremely weak. They say things like, because he can, sort of flexing his muscles kind of thing, that he's trying to test the UK because the Russians think that the UK is weak.
Along with the rush to judgment, this total lack of motive is another massive flaw in this story. Anybody, chatting about this down the pub tonight is thinking these things. The incredible thing is that the mainstream press is not allowing those things to be talked about. And that is just, I mean, what we've ended up with is we've got a mainstream press which has now become literally the spearhead of the war machine. There was a comment which was sent to me. It was written originally, I think, by the Russian ambassador to the UK, literally just a few days ago. And it was sent to me by a guy called Scott Bennett. He's a very interesting bloke to track down. He's a former US Army psychological warfare officer. He worked at the Rand Corporation designing the Arab Spring, So that's where, if you wanted to know where the Arab Spring came from, it was something called the Rand Corporation invented it. He called it a Rand Corporation product. And the idea was to sort of ferment things and stir things up so that they could be rearranged and put back in a different order, which is the way that US foreign policy wanted. And that's, of course, what happened. So anyway, one of the things he says the Russian ambassador to the UK gave an interview to Russia Today's Anastasia Cherkina about the chemical poisoning of a former Russian spy and allegations being made by PM Theresa May against Russia and Putin. So number one thing to say is all of the press and all of the British cabinet and government have done a really basic mistake. That is to conflate speculation with fact. Now, what that makes them is, guess what? They're all conspiracy theorists. Okay?
Totally right.
Anyway, what he says in this, you know, excellent intellectual, I don't know, Vladimir Nabokov, let's call him, you know, Russian ambassador, he says the blowback from this will be a separation of the thinking people from the mindless idiots in society and an increase in social distrust and hostility towards politicians and media and government institutions. This is fermenting instability and the destruction of personal civil liberties through manufactured national hysteria. Essentially, he says, they've cried wolf far too many times to be given any respect by intelligent citizens. Now, to me, that just sums it up, what's going on here, is that, and it links back to Chatham House being the origin of this kind of policy move. This is big business wanting to break up society, to fragment society, destroy government. Effectively, you're talking about a kind of anarcho-capitalist, nihilistic force which sees money and the pursuit of wealth and power as the only thing they're interested in as a way of just destroying all opposition. That is including within the government. So not only are they actually physically destroying the government by the power and the immense amount of wealth that they're accruing whilst the government is being starved of that wealth and they're not being taxed properly. So they're actually also just smashing the morale of those involved in those kind of democratic and government institutions. So that suits the book of the big financial corporates and those who are funding Chatham House. So that's what I'm saying is those institutions, I think, really are at the bottom of what's going on. And it's simply private power saying democracy can go hang as far as we're concerned. We're just going to do what we want.
Yeah, this psychological operation angle has revealed itself to me in a number of ways during this affair. And one is with this explanation that the only plausible conclusion is that Russia did it, or that Russia lost control of its stocks and so is culpable one way or the other. They don't say it's the only possible explanation. They don't say it's the only feasible explanation. They say it's the only plausible explanation. And that makes me wonder whether, you know, what's being said there is that there's a certain sphere of discourse, there's a certain way of thinking outside of which you're not allowed to go. There's a plausibility structure, which is that the West and its allies wouldn't ever be involved in anything like that.
Deeply insulting as it was in Nazi Germany to circulate the lies about the Jews being behind everything. It's just deeply insulting. It's totally disgusting. Look, I mean, the other thing we haven't mentioned is just how strangely similar this all is to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. You know, this is all, and that was proved to be total rubbish. I think what we're dealing with here is really a criminal elite who have got no interest in the lives of ordinary people here. They have just interest in their own survival because they realise that if we get a reinstitute a democratic system, a democratic government, potentially through, you know, people like Jeremy Corbyn, his ilk, the real socialists rather than the Blairites in the Labour Party actually managing to take power and start to change things in this country, that many of these people are going to be on trial. Many of them are going to be going to jail for long periods of time. Many of them's reputations will be destroyed and ruined. That's why I think these people are taking such, I think, ridiculous and extreme measures, insulting measures against, you know, the intellects of tens of millions of British people in order to get what they want, and that they're prepared to be so utterly brazen about it. I mean, you know, look, Boris Johnson, David Cameron, Nathaniel Rothschild, Jonathan Ford, the leader writer for the Times, George Osborne, all these people were in a little club in Oxford called the Bullingdon Club, where they were told, you guys will be running the show. So what's happened is they've got all these people, loads of these people who are now in positions of power, or have been recently and probably still are to a certain extent, and they've said to them in their teens, look, guys, let's just kind of, you know, really get to know it. So their loyalty is not to us. It's to their cult, their little club, their cult of people. And that's why we have the problems that we've got, is because we're in the hands of a cultish kind of criminal class.
And they clearly think that we're all stupid. This is one of the things I constantly think as I'm listening to the news. I think, how stupid do you think we really are to believe this?
Well, some people, I guess, some people don't necessarily realise what's happening. That's the trouble, I suppose. As I said, it's going to divide people into those that think the Russians are terrible. It's a very good way of dividing society, isn't it? And what does the devil do? The devil's the divider, the Freemasons, you know, the dividers and the rule, you know, the square. Yeah. This is exactly what, you know, the British Empire and the British ruling class have been doing for centuries, dividing and ruling.
You mentioned the weapons of mass destruction element there, and that reminded me of the simple fact that choosing chemical weapons as a means to carrying this out is something that Putin, I'm quite sure, would certainly not have done, because it feeds exactly into the narrative we've had about Assad using chemical weapons.
Yeah,
it's hardly mentioned. Absurd that he would do it that
hardly
way.
Mentioned.
If he was going to kill that guy off, he would have done it with, you know, sort of a pellet, a heart attack pellet or something. I mean, the kind of thing that was talked about in the 1970s that the CIA had. I'm sure the Russians have that as well.
Well, there's all sorts of ways of killing people, Julian. I'm sure there's lots of different ways of killing people. But look, the Russians destroyed all their chemical weapons about 18 months ago. There was a big ceremony, and they don't have any chemical weapons. At least that's what we're being told. And yet we're also being told they do. So I just think
if they did, is there any way that you could imagine that Putin would do that and feed into that narrative against his own interests?
There is one positive side of all of this, and I think it shows that the ruling class in Britain, in London, they say it's not really Britain, is it? It's just London. They've really lost it, you know, and that they really do think that people will believe this rubbish. And they think that George Orwell, didn't he? He resigned from the BBC in, I think, 1942, saying that the propaganda doesn't work. Because he's right, in a way. The more you try and force lies down people's throats through propaganda, the less people will believe you. Okay, so it has this effect of fracturing society, dividing society into the credulous and the intelligent, with the credulous supposedly having all the kudos and the intelligent being the conspiracy theorists or whatever. You know, really is a very, very, you know, it's topsy-turvy. So it puts the idiots in charge and the intelligentsia, that the most intelligent are somehow kind of ground down to nothing as not valuable people. Look, I mean, the effect of this is ultimately going to be, I think, the end of this Tory government. I don't think they can carry on with this kind of tactic and be taken seriously, and certainly not get elected. It would be interesting to see actually how they get on in these forthcoming local elections, particularly in London. I think they're just going to be absolutely massacred. We'll see, but I mean, I don't think
that'll be interesting, because some people have been suggesting that Theresa May is going to benefit from this.
And with Grenfell Tower too, which is absolutely disgusting, the way that the Tory government and the Tory council dealt with that, Kensington and Chelsea, still not a single arrest after all this time, after the deliberate negligence by a particular councillor from Kensington and Chelsea, a guy called Rock Fielding Mellon, who was supposedly the one who signed off the deal to change the cladding from safe cladding to dangerous cladding. He hasn't apparently even been arrested. I don't know if he's been interviewed, but certainly he's not on trial as far as I can see. And that sort of neglect, it starts to rankle with the good people of London and people of Britain. That sort of thing is not going to go unnoticed.
I wonder how many people were shocked to hear about the Gavin Williamson announcing this £48 million extra for the chemical weapons.
You know what? That sounds exactly to me like a bribe. As I said on the programme,
yes.
This is right. Just a bung. I mean, Martin was wondering whether it was organised beforehand. I don't think so. I think it was organised on the hoof. They're not playing ball. Oh, let's just chuck them some money. This is effectively a kind of gangster state we're living in at the moment, Julian, where they're behaving like gangsters. They're just, you know, let's just use a bit of this trough of money we've got here from the poor people, because, of course, the rich are almost all avoiding tax. Kevin Cahill, friend of mine, he used to write for the Sunday Times. He did a front page story for them a few years ago saying the rich pay no tax, which is I'd love to have a copy of that Sunday Times, because it's absolutely becoming true. The real winners are the super rich. The poor are just being completely destroyed under this government. And I don't think actually the British people are going to stand for it much longer.
And today we've had Boris Johnson liken Putin to Hitler.
Well, we had Prince Charles, actually.
Hillary Clinton's remark.
Prince Charles did that a few years ago, and I did an article about it saying Charles strikes another blow for the British Republic. I mean, really, you know, this guy, Johnson and Prince Charles are very close, aren't they? They're supposed to be, you know, this elite, they really do see themselves as better, which is disturbing to think that people like that could be in power. I think hopefully, I mean, the days are numbered, this lot. I think we're going to see, particularly with the rise of Prince William and Harry and the possible bypassing of Prince Charles, because he wouldn't be a popular head of state. He's just said so many ridiculous things. He's just, you know, obviously he's been involved in, many people believe, the assassination of his wife, his own wife. And, you know, he's, for example, cheating with it when it comes to the climate talks, where he's invented some kind of way of trading, which he's making loads of money out of, trading climate points. And he's also fixing laws. So if a law affects him he doesn't like the Freedom of Information Act, he then just tweaks it and changes it. And I'm not going to sign that law, and we'll just change that one before it goes. I mean, this doesn't go down well. So he's not going to be a popular head of state. And I think that there is a kind of new generation coming forward. It's just about time we got these old fossils out of the way.
Right. Well, I suppose the last thing I want to ask you is whether you think Putin is right when he thinks there are going to be more false flags coming down the line. And when you were saying that a while ago with respect to Damascus.
Well, they've shown evidence. Listen, there's evidence.
You think they're going to be there's hard more evidence false flags for this. Directed at Russia coming
There's
down.
Hard evidence for this. They've shown that there are chemical attacks being prepared in Syria, and they've actually come out with this news beforehand. So the idea is to actually stop that coming out. Now, of course, it shows the importance of channels like Russia Today, and why it's so important that these are continued to be broadcast. Why it's rather, I mean, you know, if people forget about Press TV, which I do reports on quite regularly, and that's the Iranian channel from Tehran, and that was banned. We need to have all these things. Look, go back to the Second World War.
Say that, I agree with you. I mean, each of these channels has its own propagandistic angle, but I think it's important to have that variety to look at.
So yeah, of course. Look, Al Jazeera, for example.
I think a lot of people are, you know, don't. That doesn't come into the conversation. Think, oh, well, of course, it's Russian propaganda. Well, yeah, of course it is, but
BBC
is
British propaganda. It's far worse, actually. I mean, okay, so I criticised Putin on Russia Today, and I found that when the YouTube clip went up, that bit had been cut out of the YouTube. You know, that sort of thing happens. That's just kind of normal, really, with a state broadcaster. You know, if I was to have a pop at the Queen, you might find on the BBC that when that went up on YouTube, that might be your... Anyway, that's the point really here.
Exactly.
The point here being that all of these, I mean, the BBC actually used to be much more balanced up until 1987 and the sacking of Alistair Milne, whose son is now the director of communications for Jeremy Corbyn. And he was sacked by Thatcher and by Victor Rothschild, effectively by the city. Victor Rothschild, in Peter Wright's book, Spycatcher, he makes it clear Rothschild was selecting the new director general of MI5 and MI6. That's a fantastic... I mean, if you know, it was one of those things that happened in the 1980s, and I kind of didn't read it at the time, but I read it around in the late 90s. Fascinating insight. But when it comes to press around the world, go back to the Second World War. All the way through that, Radio Luxembourg was blasting out Lord Haw Haw and his... he was a very British lord, and he was broadcasting all this kind of ridicule of the British establishment from the point of view of Nazi Germany as a Nazi propaganda station. And so there was Churchill and his bods were scratching their heads in London, saying, "Well, we could jam this, sir," you know. And the attitude was, "No, we want everyone to hear it, and if we jam it, people will think, well, wonder what they're saying." And we want everyone in Britain to have a, you know, this was a sophisticated approach, and it's a confident approach which was taken in the Second World War. What they did is they had shows on the BBC which were ridiculing Lord Haw Haw, and they had actual genuine criticism of it. So they reacted to it, but they reacted in a very mature and sensible way. So people could listen to Lord Haw Haw if they wanted to. But then, you know, they knew that they were being fed Russian... they were being fed Nazi propaganda. Now the opposite is true. It's like we are the Nazis. We are trying to feed propaganda around the world, and we're not prepared to listen to points of view of other countries. Now that inevitably is going to lead to war unless we have some really serious political change in this country.
Absolutely. Well, thanks very much, Tony, for spending all this time and just coming out with this avalanche of information, which you said you were going to do.
Well, I did. And also, just one other little thing. I just like to add...
I'm going to actually leave in, but you know what I mean? I shall...
I just wanted to add one little tiny thing at the end, and that is some research I did over Christmas, which I found absolutely fascinating, about the English Civil War, because this, I mean, it's a period which has fascinated me for a long time. And I looked into the killing of Charles I. Now, Cromwell's not a popular man in Ireland, and many would say that he was deliberately instigating the civil war as it was a kind of clash of classes. It wasn't a revolution, as some people try and pretend it was. It was the triumph of the merchant class over the feudal class. And the feudal landowning classes were fairly, you know, relatively speaking, benevolent. I mean, they were pretty awful, but they had to live with the people that lived on their land. And there was a whole, you know, different system, a way of doing things. The king represented the feudal classes. The merchants were making money from trade and were avaricious. They controlled cities, city states, that sort of thing. But they didn't control the whole country, and they wanted to control Britain. And the reason was because Charles I had instituted taxes on them for enclosing the land, for evicting people from poor people from their land in enclosures and that sort of thing. So he was fining the big merchants for kicking people off the land. I mean, that was a process that led to Britain being the first country that had mass urbanisation, because so many people had been evicted, they had to go to the cities. It led to the Industrial Revolution, because there was this mass supply of cheap labour. People were desperate for food in the cities and had to work for their food and accommodation. And so Cromwell represented that merchant class. Now, there was a denouement at the end of the Civil War where legally Cromwell had to get rid of the king. He had to, you know, dispatch him. The only trouble was he knew that he had to do it legally. And so he got together. Now, this is alleged by a French pamphleteer, Abbé Laridan. And he was writing in France, because France had become really the centre for opposition to the Civil War. So many people fled the Civil War, went to France, including Charles II, you know, who then came back in the Restoration. And this pamphlet explains that Cromwell formed the first open Masonic lodge in Britain in 1648 with the express purpose of killing the king, because he knew that if the king was to, if he was to fail to get an indictment against the king, a death warrant, then what would happen was the establishment may turn on him, and it might be him that got the chop. So he couldn't really allow things to go to chance. So he got together something like 15, 20 people to form a lodge. And this lodge was then part of the conspiracy to purge Parliament, to make sure that they had only the people who supported Cromwell left. And then to have, I think they called it a Star Council or Star Court or something, in order to get the regicides, to get the death warrant for the king. At the trial of Charles I, Even Lord Fairfax, who was the head of the army, was Cromwell's boss, his wife, shouted out at the top of her voice, "That's rubbish. Most of the people in this country support the king, not you, Cromwell." And yet he got his death warrant and Charles I lost his head. But I think it's fascinating that this was the process that was used to actually, and he goes into quite a lot of detail, this French abbe, in explaining that there was a whole ceremony involving Solomon's Temple. And they used this idea of the sort of reconstructing Solomon's Temple to formulate this first lodge. And then, I mean, that was 1648. The king lost his head in 1649. And then Freemasonry was made public, because that was a totally secret operation that was revealed by this French abbe, but in 1717, but by which time there were quite a lot of these Masonic lodges around the country. But I just think that's a fascinating angle into the history and the origins of Freemasonry, which is still very powerful today, of course. And
it's a whole interview in itself, actually.
And well, okay, but
you sound like you know a lot about this.
Well, we've had a load of stuff in the Guardian recently about it. We've even had the Guardian with an article saying that the people should seriously look at conspiracies like the Illuminati conspiracy, and actually saying that it's the only sane thing to do, which I couldn't quite believe reading that in the Guardian.
Really? Wow, and, could you give me the link to that?
Well, I'm sure. I can't remember the actual title. It was about 6 weeks ago or something, and I was reading it thinking, God, this is actually some damn good journalism. But it was just after they'd done a load of exposés on Masonic lodges in Parliament and Masonic lodges in the press lobby. So Mason journalists and Mason politicians cooking things up and cooking up the coverage of Parliament together. And that, I think, was Ian Cobain in The Guardian did all those articles. And then there was a massive attack back by the Freemasons. This is where the establishment, it's effectively a kind of religious cult at the heart of the British establishment. And it's very much represented by the Tory party. And
they've been complaining, haven't they, that their numbers have been going down for years and they're not very
well. It's because I think because there's something kind of cold and dry about the whole thing, and it's not, you know, it's changed in its character, Julian, as well. Masons I've spoken to have told me that the lodges have been purged of decent people, and a lot of really ruthless people have been put in charge as masters of those lodges. So the character of the organisation has also changed a great deal over the last 30 or 40 years. You know, I think the whole thing is a conspiracy, personally. I mean, I would, wouldn't I? But, you know, the idea is to actually use this organisation to control society. It's effectively a kind of method of fascistic control. You know, you could use it in a benevolent way if you've got benevolent. And I think originally Freemasonry was quite like that. It was a kind of speakeasy thing, but it's been completely hijacked. And the secrecy, the idea of swearing an oath to kill yourself or to be killed if you speak out of line, if you betray the secrets of the lodge, then in most countries, in fact, in Singapore, where I was recently, it's a criminal offence to be a member of a society like this, you know.
Is it really?
And I think that should be the norm, because your loyalty is to that absolutely secret society and that religious cult. Absolutely. It's not to the people you're supposed to be serving.
Yeah, absolutely. That makes total sense, because it is just open to abuse, isn't it? The whole structure is open to abuse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Before you go, I just want to ask you if you know much about Gavin Williamson, because I find him the most implausible person. And he's just such a yes man all the time. It's incredible.
He is. He seems, should we just say, shallow. When we were at the BBC, they made a big play of you've got to be authoritative. Well, there's nothing authoritative about him. He just seems like he's playing at being a defence secretary. God only knows who decided that he'd make a good defence secretary. I don't think if he was in any kind of combat situation that he'd be the one that all of the hardened soldiers would turn to for advice. No. And yet he's at the head of the whole military establishment in the country. I mean,
is it just because he is a yes man? Is it because he thinks the right thoughts and he will have...
Okay, what we've got is a bunch of cowards and control freaks in charge. He's one of the cowards. He's a pliable stooge. He's just he will do as he's told. He will read from the script and he will probably burble his lines. But at least he's a so-called safe pair of hands that will do what he's told. And I'm afraid that is the way that governments die. I mean, the thing is, remember, all in the background, all the time, you've got big corporations who are growing in strength all the time as our government is dying around us. And this means that they won't be regulated. They can do what they want. They can commit crimes with impunity. That's exactly the way these big, you know, powerful, rich directors want it.
Do you think there's anything to be said for what, you know, the Skripal affair that we'd be talking about as being something entirely directed in a private way?
I think so, potentially. I mean, it's got to have some major parts of the Ministry of Defence, of the interesting, you know, so the way that the Wiltshire police have been totally sidelined. I think it was, I can't remember the guy's name. He was a really good chief constable, Mike Veal, I think. The Wiltshire chief constable who spoke out about Ted Heath back at the end of last year, saying yes, he definitely was a child molester. I've seen however many scores of witnesses and spoken to them and seen the statements and everything. He was definitely a child abuser, and then he got pilloried in the London press for saying that, and then the Daily Mail wrote an article which was supportive of him. He's now been transferred out of Wiltshire up to Cleveland, I think, and some pliable stooge put in his place. Now, I can imagine Mike Veal, if the anti-terrorist police had been brought in immediately to saying, clear out Wiltshire police, we're taking over, Mike Veal would have been the sort of guy who would be going on the Channel 4 News saying, look, I'm not having this. My officers are going to investigate this case, not these jumped up crooks from Scotland Yard, which the anti-terrorist police are. I mean, they've been involved in so many of the, I mean, basically they're like MI5, they're virtually MI5, they're halfway between the Met and MI5, they are very, very close to them. And we know that they have been involved in all sorts of, you know, criminal activities with previous terror attacks. So we're talking about people who have been reported to them and have then gone on to get hold of guns, ammunition, murder people in the street, you know, this kind of, you know, this kind of anti-terror core in London is responsible for the terror. Just as the FBI in the US is responsible for so much of the terror there, they are actually, you know, instituting this. They're not investigating it, they're instituting it. And I would put the anti-terrorist police that are now down in Salisbury in parallel with the same FBI who were supposedly investigating the Boston bombers, for example, and then one of the guys who was a suspect was delivered to the FBI. And he was shown to be delivered to them naked with his hands tied behind his back, and yet later he was found shot dead. Now, don't tell me that there was a fight and a struggle. He was shot by the FBI. The FBI and MI5 are the greatest threat to national security right now and must be thoroughly investigated and certainly not to be trusted. I think Mike Veal is the sort of chief constable in Wiltshire who would have taken them to task over some of these matters and said, actually, that's my jurisdiction. Get off my patch.
All right. Thank you again, Tony.
You're welcome.